Can you state your full name and for the record?
My name is John L. Johnson.
Okay. Okay, now I'm going to the question. I understand that you were one of the citizens who acted as a watchdog over the desegregation process. What were you doing in Champaign in the mid and late 1960s, and what role did you play in the desegregation of Champaign's public schools?
I lived here in the 60s. I was born here. I went to school in both the Champaign and the Abandoned School Districts. And during that time, I was actively involved in a lot of different things, but one of them was the desegregation of the Champaign and the Abandoned Public Schools.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of motivated you to get involved?
As I indicated, this is my home. I've always been deeply interested in the quality of life for everybody in the home, but in our home, but particularly the quality of life of African-American people. We lived in a depressed area here in Champaign and Urbana, and education is an important element of helping people to rise above that situation. So I was deeply concerned with the overall plans that were being discussed and being proposed and how those plans affected the black community.
Okay. What were some of the other people, black or white, who were watchdogs over the process?
Oh, I don't know. It's been a long time ago. There was David Sessions. There was an Irma Bridgewater. These are African-American people. There was a committee that was called the CCQE, the Coordinating Committee for Quality Education. I believe that's what the acronym stood for. This was a group, a biracial group of both black and white citizens who had come together to foster a moderate school deseg plan. And what they were attempting to do was react to the whole issues of what was done in Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, where the Supreme Court had ruled separate was not equal. And what they claimed they were doing was creating a plan that would not result in a federal mandated desegregation plan on the Champaign Public Schools. I was a part of what we call the People's Poverty Board, but initially that was a small group of people that was headed by Roy Williams and myself, and ultimately we allowed another young man to participate with us, his mother and father happened to have been the founders of the new math system here at the University of Illinois. He was deeply concerned and shared in some of that concern with us. But that was really, I can't go back and remember all of the people's names that were involved in it. There was a large group of people that made up the CCQE, and there were quite a number of African-American people that had came and joined that process, talking about how Champaign schools should desegregate themselves.
Did you see more whites or blacks trying to reach out to the community and help the education?
Well, the way the process was structured was that there were a group of white citizens who had begun a discussion of desegregating the Champaign schools in lieu of the federal government coming in and mandating that process. Remember, this was the time in which the Champaign schools were segregated. Blacks attended elementary segregation. Blacks attended their own elementary schools. Whites attended theirs. There were a middle school in which both black and whites attended, and then there was a high school. What whites allegedly said they were doing was trying to get a fair start in this process that would prevent the U.S. Department of Education and the federal government from coming in and mandating a solution on the Champaign community. There were blacks who were involved in it. There were blacks whose spouses were members of the Champaign school system and that they were teachers. There were blacks who were white collar workers who worked at Chinook Air Base and held administrative positions. There were some blue collar workers who were mail persons who worked for the U of I Mail Department as well as the U.S. Mail Department. And there were school teachers who were a part of the community, who were all a part of this whole group of people that were discussing desegregation in the Champaign schools.
Okay.
I have a follow-up. That committee, the coordinating committee that you were saying, how does that differ? Was that a grassroots? Was that affiliated with the school board where, you know, the EEOC that had Barksdall and Evans on it, those folks, it was a committee the school board had formed to make the plan? How did this...
That was a grassroots committee. As I recall, I believe that committee was formulated by Harry Thibault, who was a professor here at the University of Illinois and served for many, many years as the county chairperson of the Democratic Party. As I recall, it was a grassroots initiative made up of quote-unquote liberal-minded people who felt that by taking their own initiative, they would prevent the federal government from coming down and mandating a solution on the whole community.
How did this group work with the formal group that was mandated by the school board to create the plan?
Well, you got to remember now, I was inside, but yet outside of this process and did not support the initiative as was unfolding. Both plans called for the elimination of the elementary schools that were sited in the black community. We opposed that solution on the basis that we were losing our schools and our children would all be uplifted from our neighborhood and carried somewhere else. The debate that went on in the black community centered around the value of a segregated education versus the value of a desegregated education. There were many people who felt that despite the fact that there would be hardships on black children, the ultimate benefits that they would obtain from this desegregation far outweighed those hardships. We did not support that. That was not something that Roy Williams and myself thought was fair, thought was equitable. We did not quite understand the details of the law as we understand them now. That what ultimately became the Champaign Plan was really unconstitutional and illegal. But black people didn't know that. And this came off on the heels of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, and the real concern, overriding concern by many black residents was that they had to do something that would provide an increased educational benefit to black kids.
Okay. So basically, they were planning to do everything they could to get the blacks in the schools, but they didn't really care about, like, what they would, like, sacrifice in order to get them there?
Well, the blacks were attending the schools already, but they were attending segregated schools. They were attending elementary schools in their own neighborhood. Whites were attending elementary schools in their own neighborhoods. What blacks felt that the overriding best interests of black kids were to attend schools with white kids. There was the overriding assumption, and this was brought about nationally by research that was done by the NAACP, that blacks inherently received an inferior education in segregated schools. And many blacks felt from the national scene down that the best way of improving the quality education of black kids were to put them in classes with white kids. That way you would improve the facilities, you would improve the curriculums, and you would improve the teaching staff. That was the overriding argument. Contrary to all of that was that you would have to take these kids from their neighborhood and bus them somewhere else. And we felt that there was an overriding burden on these kids to be bused that didn't justify, quote-unquote, the educational benefits. We lost that argument. The black community concurred with the plan, signed off on the plan, and the plan ultimately was implemented.
Okay, now, if you had have went back a few years and when the United States first came up with a separate but not equal plan, if say that they had of held up their side of the bargain with that, do you think that like history would have been changed or it would have went out some different way?
I don't think history would have been changed if we would have kept the same factors that we have today. We quite simply did not understand then, and we don't understand now, the impacts of a desegregated educational system. There appears to be such inherent difference between black kids and white kids that teachers simply can't figure out this difference and can't teach that difference equally. We didn't know then, as I indicated earlier, what we know now, that we were picking up a whole race of people and moving them from their neighborhood to someone else's neighborhood. That's illegal. You can't do that now. But it was done then, and it couldn't have been done then. But we didn't know that, and no one complained about that. The benefits that we thought that we would receive, we never received. Our kids never improved better on the average than we thought they would be or than they were promised that they would because of the desegregation. In fact, our kids have lost ground over the four decades since Champaign has desegged their schools.
Okay. I'm sure that you're, I assume that you're familiar with the Plain Truth newspaper?
A little bit.
Okay. Do you know what role the Plain Truth played in the desegregation process?
Well, it really played very little role. It was a newspaper in which was founded by the People's Poverty Board, which Roy Williams, myself, and Peter Rasmussen constituted that board. There were articles that were written on a weekly basis opposing the deseg of the Champaign schools. But you got to remember, that paper was going up against national policies and national trends. It was going up against a hard-fought battle before the United States Supreme Court, in which one of the major civil rights issues was won, which was won by the NAACP regarding the integration or the desegregation of the American school systems. There was a great deal of discussions at a lot of different levels, sociologically, psychologically, economically, of the benefits that would accrue to black communities across America through the desegregation. Black people in Champaign and probably throughout our country were in no mood to buy into the same old dialogue that we should keep our schools the way they are. Remember now, we did not control school boards. School boards were exclusively ran by the white community. We had no input into the overall policies of the school systems here in Champaign and Urbana. We had very little to say about what the curriculum was then and what the curriculum is now, and what resources of the district's resources would go into that. Now, some of that was discussed in the detail that I'm discussing it now, but not all of it, because I think that those factors were put aside from the overall benefit that many black people felt that the kids would receive from desegregating our schools. And also keep in mind that there was an element of the white community who had came to the black community saying to the black community, this need to be done. And prior to that, there had been very few times in which the white community had ever knocked on the door of the black community saying that we should be in partnerships to do anything. Now, part of that, I think, in retrospect, kind of blinded black people. You know, and again, we were a community that was without quote-unquote intellectuals. We did not have lawyers. We did not have real social scientists. We didn't have people who was familiar with the law and who could interpret the laws to us and who could tell us what the Supreme Court meant in their decisions and how it would affect us. So many black people felt that they were getting the best deal. And we have fought that. I mean, this was a deep-rooted issue among black people. This was not something that black people decided overnight, and after that night had passed, they were willing to change their minds. Many of them have held to that position even today, that the ultimate benefit to their children has indeed resulted from the desegregation of the Champaign schools.
Okay. We understand that you were against the desegregation plan at first or ultimately, and that you thought that the plan was unconstitutional. Exactly how was it unconstitutional?
Well, my original opposition to the plan had nothing to do with the Constitution in that I was unable at that time to articulate the constitutional implications of the plan. I just knew that to close all of our schools down and to force our children to attend schools away from their neighborhood was not a good deal for us. The only people that were losing in this deal were black kids. I mean, whites got a chance to keep their schools. They got new schools. If their schools were closed down, we got no new schools. The only school we got out of it was Washington Elementary School. All the other schools were closed down. That was not a good deal. I did not know then the questions of structural displacement. I did not know then the questions of the implications on achievement and burdens assumed by one race for the satisfaction of another race. These became constitutional elements of school desegregation that I learned much, much later from the time that Champaign was discussing their desegregation plan.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that you said that some of the schools were torn down and they never rebuilt the black ones. Why were they torn down in the first place?
Well, they were torn down because the strategy of the white community was that because we had won in the Supreme Court and the white community had been told that your school systems in America and how you have designed them, school systems only for blacks, school systems for yourself, were unconstitutional. And it said to the white community, you must now integrate your schools. You must now bring black kids and white kids together. That would mean that school boards all across America would have to figure out how to bring these groups together. What the white communities did in our community, and they did in most places in the country, that they tore down the schools in the black community, they closed them. And then, therefore, forced the black community to attend their schools. And those schools that they had that were old, as our schools were old, they simply tore them down and built new schools. But they built these new schools in their neighborhoods or on agricultural sites, which ultimately they built neighborhoods around. A good example of that would be Cary Busey, which is still situated next to a cornfield. But originally, when Cary Busey was there, all of that area was corn. There was no houses at Cary Busey at all. Let's see. You take Cary Busey, you take Bottenfield, you take Garden Hills, you take, I think Dr. Howard was an original school that was there. I think Southside may have been there. But in the main, all of the schools south of University Avenue were new schools resulting from the DSEG plan. We lost Lawhead Elementary School. We lost Gregory School. We lost Willard School, which were schools in our neighborhood in Champaign. We lost Hay School in Urbana, which became Martin Luther King Elementary School in Urbana. But that was the plan, and no one really understood that. Black people thought then it was a good deal because your kids were going to be able to go and sit down in the same room with white children. And they thought it was not a hard price to pay, that white kids were allowed to walk to their schools and blacks would have to be bused to theirs. No one talked about homework time. No one talked about activities before schools, activities after school. Those kinds of discussions did not go into it. There was no discussions of what the curriculum would be, what extra school activities would be, and how that would impact upon African-American children from participating in those activities.
Did anyone do anything when the schools were torn down?
What do you mean, do anything?
Like, did they take any action?
No, it was a part of a plan that was approved by the entire community, including the African-American community also. School districts are unusual legal bodies in that they have a wide discretion of authority within state governments to operate their schools. And tearing down schools are something that school districts do often. And it's not illegal unless it results in structural displacement of people because of their race.
Which
that's
is
unconstitutional.
What happened, right?
That is what happened. That's unconstitutional. But you can tear a school down and build a new school anywhere that the school district feels that that's warranted. But when you're moving one race of kids at the benefit of another race of kids, that's illegal. That's a violation of Illinois' Constitution, Equal Protection Clause, and it's a violation. And at the time in the United States Constitution did not have a clause dealing with that. So the Supreme Court and Congress had to create a whole new clause to make that a violation of the law.
So there were complaints after?
No complaints.
There weren't?
No. The black community, let me say this again. The black community agreed to and shared in the desegregation plans of the Champaign schools. The people who were opposed to that plan was Roy Williams and John Lee Johnson and the People's Poverty Board. The people who I talked about, the blue-collar workers, the white-collar workers, all agreed to the plan. They believed, the church leaders agreed to the plan. They believed that the ultimate benefits to the black community outweighed the negative issues that we talked about. And therefore, they bought in on it. It was something that the black community welcomed. And I think I said, even today, there are many blacks who feel, despite all the evidence, that black kids overwhelmingly benefits from the desegregation of the Champaign schools.
Okay. The desegregation plan turned Washington School from an all-black...
Sorry, I'm going to stop. Pardon me. Before you go on, I do have a follow-up. One of the things that Danielle and Brooke want to get are stories with your analysis. So I'm wondering if the two of you and the People's Poverty Board were the only ones sort of speaking against this plan and the whole rest of the black community and the white community, liberal whites, wanted this, there must have been conflicts. Do you have any stories that illustrate some of the work and the difference of opinion that kind of, you know, can you give us some stories about
I would that? Only talk about them in generality. Those people are still alive.
Okay, we don't have to use names.
Right.
Do you have any stories of conversations you had where, you know, that illustrate the different opinions and the different strategies? Can you remember a conversation? Again, you don't have to name names.
Well, there were numerous conversations. And as I indicated earlier, that blacks argued over one component. I don't know what whites argued over because we were not privy to what the white community discussed when they were discussing their plans. We argued over issues of busing. We argued over issues of blacks losing their schools, blacks being transported from their neighborhood to other neighborhoods. As I indicated, from the ministerial leadership to black people who had attended the schools, who attended the segregated schools in Champaign, individually and collectively, they all felt that this was something that they wanted done, and they virtually said to Roy Williams and John Lee Johnson, you guys shut your mouths. You know, this is something that we think is in our best interest. And this was a fight that went on for 30-some-odd years. It's still going on today. I mean, the black community was not overwhelmingly happy because suit was filed against the Champaign schools.
Now that you say that the argument is still going on, I'm aware that you sued the school district many times. Was that ever one of the topics?
Not many times. We did not have resources to hire attorneys in those days to sue the school district. And I think, to be honest, there probably was just a very few attorneys across America who really understood school deseg law. There could have been a lot of them. I don't know. But it was something that was new. There's not a lot of attorneys even today who understands that law and are willing to tackle school districts because of the complications of the law and all of the statistics that's involved in it. So that hampered us. But throughout that period, we filed complaints to the Office of Civil Rights. There were investigations done of the Champaign schools on the numbers of kids that were dumped in special education. You know, I mean, that's strange because we came back to that issue 25 years later and filed another complaint against it. But despite all of that, the black community were convinced that their decision to sign with the school district was the best decision. And it was almost as if no one wanted to look themselves in the face and say, okay, we were wrong. This was not a good decision, and we should not have made that decision. That is not to say, looking back over yesterday, that we could have overruled the Supreme Court. We could not have overridden the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said separate was not equal, meaning that we could not have legally kept our schools segregated. But if we would have been a little bit more intelligent, we may have been able to get better schools in Northeast Champaign with more white kids attending those schools instead of having a situation where structurally all of our kids were uprooted and sent to schools in Southwest Champaign. And even today, when you talk to some of the people that were around here in Champaign then and that was a part of these issues, they kind of frowned. They don't want to be reminded of it, anything like that. So, there were all kinds of debates that went on. But keep in mind that some of the people who participated in the desegregation of the Champaign schools were, their spouses were employees of the Champaign schools. Even though they were teaching in segregated schools, they were teachers. They were teachers. And some of them, I think, felt that they had a greater allegiance to the Board of Education than they had to the black community. But our arguments, and to be fair, were new arguments. I mean, you go back and you think that here the United States Supreme Court has said to white America, you can't continue to segregate your schools. Black kids are being denied a quality education, a quality facility. They're being denied a fair share of their taxation. And then all of a sudden, somebody stands up and says, yeah, that's true, but we don't want to integrate well. It takes a very strong character person to buy that argument. The argument that had been presented to the court was an argument that represented most of the schools in America, the quality of those schools, and what many black people felt was the quality of the education children were receiving from those schools. And they were hell-bent on desegregating the American school system. Yeah. So that was the face of that argument.
When you say that that they had decided to bust the blacks, wasn't that further indicating that blacks were inferior to the whites? Because they could have said that, okay, we'll bust some of the white students to the black schools, but no, they decided to tear our schools down and send the black students to the white schools.
Well, it wasn't ever a question of inferiority. It could have been in white people's mind, some white people, but that was not a question. There were learning years difference between the two races. Whites scored better in math, languages, other areas of curriculum than blacks did. But that had, in essence, really nothing to do with the segregated schools. That had more to do with the poverty of black kids. The reason for that is that now that we have deseg schools and black kids are attending newer facilities with better curriculums, that learning gap still exists. 30, 40 years later, that learning gap still exists. But we didn't know that then. We didn't know that. We assumed that the root of the problem had all to do with the buildings, it had all to do with the curriculum, it had all to do with the teaching core. And in fact, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the poverty that the kids lived in who went to school. And yet, there were good examples of what Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP legal team that fought this issue before the United States Supreme Court had all went to segregated schools. Be it they were attorneys, and Thurgood Marshall ultimately became a member of the Supreme Court. How did that happen? How did they achieve that? And they attended segregated schools. So clearly, blacks can learn in a segregated school system. It has to do with the value of the teachers, the values of the children, and the value of their parents, and how they place the education, the learning value within their community. So when you go back, now I'm looking from hindsight now. Remember now, I'm looking back 30, 35, 40 years. That was not knowledge that we had then. So we talked about it from a gut reaction then, that this is not right, as opposed to you can pull out the achievement data now. You know, you can pull out the ISAT test now. That was not available then. But even when you pull that information out and discuss these comparisons in front of black people, some of them are not impressed, and some of them do not buy into that data. You know, but you can't say because there's a difference in the learning between black kids and white kids today, let's go back to segregated schools, because the law doesn't allow you to do that. And which is what we sued them for, and what the consent decree, which exists today, is trying to close that gap. It's not doing it as quick as I would want it to do, but that's the ultimate interest. But if you go back and look what we were talking about then, a lot of this information was not available to the average black on the street. As I indicated, we didn't have any black faculty members from the Department of Education or from the law school who could come across to our community and say, this is what the Supreme Court meant when they ruled on the desegregation of the schools. This is how school boards can get around you. This is what they're doing now. You can now walk over to the Department of Education at the University of Illinois, and there's somebody there who knows about every DSEG plan in America, who knows about what every school board has done, either to implement that plan or to get around that plan. There could have been people there then, but those people did not come into the black community and say, wait a minute here, you're going to get the short end of this stick if you buy into this. That was not what was presented. What was presented was this collection of well-intended white citizens along with well-intended black citizens who had came together with the sole purpose of desegregating the Champaign schools.
Did you have a follow-up question? Okay. As I was going to say earlier, the desegregation plan turned Washington School from an all-black population with nearly all-black teachers into an integrated magnet school with an emphasis on science. White children who went to that school were bused. Black children who lived in the Washington school area could no longer go to that school unless they applied to go there. Many teachers who taught at Washington were sent elsewhere. What was your opinion on that?
Well, Washington's role was to replace Lawhead. And for you guys who do not know Lawhead School, it's the parking lot, which is on the west side of the street across from the annex of Douglas Center. There's a parking lot which is adjacent to the church. Yeah. That was Lawhead School. And to replace Willard School, which is the parking lot behind Salem Church. Because those two schools had been torn down, the discussion by the Board of Education at that time, there had to be a school there in order for whites to attend. Because up until that time, under the plan, all whites were being transported out of the black community. And that plan clearly was not a constitutional plan. And here comes the Vern Barksdalls and them. They come in at that part of it. And so the decision was that they would build a new elementary, a two-strand building in Douglas Park area, and they would call it Washington School. And what they would do is that they would make it a magnet school. Now, magnet schools were allowed under the Supreme Court ruling as a means of attracting the white community into the black community. Now, remember that the emphasis of the whole DSEG case by the NAACP was not asking white people to bring their children to the black community. It was asking the court to allow black children to go to white schools. Okay. And the reason for that emphasis probably was on the fact that black schools did not meet the same quality as white schools. And they probably felt that because of that, it would be much better for black kids wherever they were in the American public school systems to leave their buildings and to go into white schools. So the question of declaring Washington School as a magnet school was not to attract black kids to it, but was to bring white kids in it. And by bringing white kids into Washington School under a special curriculum operated school, then the Champaign schools were able to maintain a legal desegregated plan. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're smarter than I am.
Okay. I understand.
I'm just joking with you.
Okay. Is the idea of a charter or magnet school a good idea in your opinion?
Well, it all depends upon what the goals are. I mean, it's a good idea for families who are looking for unique curriculums because they have children who want to specialize in arts, sciences, languages. It's a good idea if you want to attract special groups of people to neighborhoods who don't look on those neighborhoods as where they would want their children attending. There's nothing bad with chartered or other Pacific schools, as long as those schools do not lock out children who reside within those neighborhoods. One of the reasons that we included Washington School in our racial complaint that was filed in 97 against the Champaign schools because it locked out the children who live closest to the school, and they were not allowed to attend that school. And that's why it was included, and that's why the special designation that Washington School held prior to that suit was lifted.
Why were they not allowed to go to the school?
The assumption by the school board and other people that the children who lived around Washington were inferior to the white kids that were being bused from the South to the schools, and the promise that the Board of Education had made to those parents that we were providing you with an exceptional education that you can't get anywhere else in the district but at Washington School, and to assure you of that exceptional accelerated curriculum, we're only going to bring in children of color who can match your children's learning speed, and that there would be nothing that would slow your children down in learning. What I'm telling you is the truth.
I mean, I ain't never heard only school I heard of something like that is a private school, because...
No.
Because schools in a district today...
That's what they have. They have that now in school of choice. But what they don't have is the locking out of students.
Yeah.
But under the choice system, you can choose a school for your child based upon the curriculum of that school. You can also choose a school based upon, the accelerated learning of the kids in that school. The problem that black kids have, particularly those black kids who come from the area north of University Avenue, is that their learning proportionately is slower than their white counterparts. And that learning is slower not because there's a difference in their mental capacity, because there's a real difference in preparation, is that white families spend far more time in preparing their children for school than black families. So as a result of that difference in preparations, when white kids get there, they can be 1, 2, or even 3 mean years ahead of their black counterpart. And so if you're teaching a class to the mid-level of that class, and the mid-level is the kids are 3 years advanced to the kids who are not, then that means the kids who are less than that are always going to be behind, because you can't teach to them. You're teaching to those kids who are able to learn at that rate. And black families have not figured that out.
Is that where the special education problem came in?
Well, it didn't come in because of that, but that's one of the reasons that there are so many blacks dumped into special education by the Champaign schools and the abandoned schools. But that's another reason why you have medication that's given to children.
Mm-hmm.
Because teachers do not have, we're getting off the subject, but I think that young teachers should not be teaching elementary school. I think that older teachers, more mature teachers, teachers who have born children, who have raised children, need to be teaching elementary schools. Because the greatest problems in teaching children to learn are small children. But we believe in this country that young girls fresh out of college should be sent to our elementary schools. And they just simply don't know how to handle it. And as a result of it, children who are different, children who may have different lifestyles or different race or all of that are simply swept under the rug. That was a problem that occurred then, back in the DSEG of the Champaign schools. It's a problem that occurs even today. We have not gotten over the hump of that. And despite the fact that these have been some of the overriding issues related to the disparities, blacks have not figured that out. We still have not figured it out. There are still not discussions in the black community about the preparation of their children and how to support that. Now, part of that reason can be is that your parents, if your parents grew up here in Champaign, they were educated in a school system that gave them an inferior education in general. Not every black kid got an inferior education, but in the main, most black kids did because they didn't come to school prepared. So that could have soured their taste on the Champaign and the Urbana schools. But keep in mind that the freed man, that's the man who was a slave and who became freed, had no education, but yet thirst for an education because he understood the value of education to his slave master. And he also understood that if he was to assume the same kinds of authority in his community that the slave master took for granted, he had to be educated. Now, why don't we know that now? Why don't we know that today? Why can't we figure that out? And yet, if you look at the latest audits that were done on the Champaign schools, you will still see this gap between the achievement of black and white students in all categories.
So basically, the still problems remain as to the preparation of black students when they get to elementary school?
Yes, but keep in mind, then it was structural problems. Then it was tearing down buildings, picking up kids, hauling them from one side of town to the other side of town. Then there was this whole debate of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, and what all that meant. It was a whole, I think, acceleration by black people that our kids are going to get, for the first time, a chance to go to white schools, all of that there. And we didn't look into the details. We didn't really understand the details of the DSEG plan. And there were black people who were well thought of then. As I said, there were black people who were blue-collar workers, white-collar workers. In the main, there were very few of these people who lived in Northeast Champaign. There were very few who lived outside of Northeast Champaign, but there were very few people who lived in the black community of Champaign who had college degrees. There were very few black people who had professional certificates. You know, I mean, at one time, the most degreed people in Northeast Champaign were people with an elementary education certificate and people who worked at the post office, meaning that there were no people who were doctors. There were no people who were lawyers. There were no people who were engineers. There were no people who had those kinds of credentials who would have been able to understand three-dimensional problems. So there were not people who could interpret for the black community what this issue was. So when you had people who were elders in their church because of what they did in their community saying, this is a good deal. I mean, you think they're going to buy in what John Lee Johnson is saying? This young 21, 22-year-old so-called angry black guy who's telling them, no, they shouldn't do this. No, this is not in our interest. No. No, they're not. Today, there are different issues. You know, there are different issues. We're not talking about structurally tearing down buildings and all of that there. We're talking about achievement, learning gaps. We talked about it then. But the gap then we thought would be closed by the desegregation of the schools. We assumed that just by getting these kids into these buildings in South Champaign, that it was miraculously going to improve their learning skills. Now, it was supposed to, because what was supposed to happen, and there, see, this is a tricky thing. And the reason that it's tricky, because you're talking about human beings, and that there is no single factor that really dictates people, that if you would bring kids together and kids are able to see kids who are studying, who are achieving, and who have a hunger to learn, and kids who have not been around that, but sense it and sees it, that they can adopt that same hunger. They can adopt that same encouragement to learn. That was what Thurgood Marshall and them said to the Supreme Court. And that's part of what the court bought in on, that there would be some miraculously improvement in the learning desire of black kids just because they sit down beside a white kid. Now, to show you how this works, here's how you can look at this. If you could go somewhere in Northeast Champaign, there is one place, but I'm talking about in general, and you could find a room like this room where there is a radio console, microphones, and that there is something going on, that something going on would serve to elevate kids' desire to learn. But when you can't find that, and kids are unaware that things like this room even exist, then they don't aspire for it because they don't even know that it goes on. Well, these kinds of things may not be taken for granted in the white community, but these things are known by many whites in their community because they have these things. We don't have those things. So the concept was that if you put black and white kids in the same room together, then that desire by white kids to learn would rub off on black kids. Okay? It didn't happen out that way. Not in the main. It did happen for many blacks. It didn't happen that way. That's the same thing that's in segregated schools where you got one group of kids who are good and that impacts another group of kids. But then you had all the subparticles of the racial tensions, all of that, which I think served to minimize the ability of kids to achieve. Diversity did not win out, and a lot of that could have been that school officials were not really prepared to understand it. Many school officials didn't really care, didn't want to understand it. What they wanted to do was to maintain their own control and to ensure that their kids benefited from it. Black communities were not really decisive voices in school politics. We weren't managing buildings, and we really had very little to say about how the curriculums and how the schools were managed. So when you go back and you look at our community, well, where were our places that we could discuss these kinds of things? Well, it was in our church and from our church into our homes. And this was not a discussion in our church. This ceased to be a topic that many ministers wanted to talk about. And some of that had to do with there was such transition among black church leadership that many ministers who came in didn't know anything about the Champaign desegregation plan, didn't come in committed to the whole question of education, didn't see it as a primary topic issue that they wanted to discuss before, during, or after their sermons. And as a result of it, this is my opinion. As a result of it, many blacks were lullaby to sleep over it. They forgot about it. They forgot that these were day-to-day battles that their children were facing and that the school districts were losing and that the DSEG plan did not satisfy that, the problems are still here today.
Okay, you talked about some racial tensions in the schools. Did they ever ask the white people how they felt about it before they did it? Because maybe if they had asked them, they probably wouldn't have done it, because I don't think most of them would have wanted it, and maybe that was a factor in how the white kids responded in school.
Well, you're correct. All of that is correct. Whites did not want it. It was the law. It is the law. We happen to live in a nation that is ruled by law. The courts do not necessarily ask you if you like it. The court says this is what the Constitution says that must be done. And because the Constitution said that it must be done as interpreted by the court, then every American was obligated to abide by that law. But as I said, earlier, that what white people said was, okay, if we got to do it, we'll do it our way. If you have gone to court and you've won a case to go to school with us, then you're going to go to school with us. We're not going to go to school with you. So you're going to have to leave your neighborhood and come to our neighborhood and go to school. We're not going to leave our neighborhood and go to your neighborhood and go to school. We're not going to create curriculums that represent you. You're going to learn us. We're not going to teach you about you, or we're not going to teach ourselves about you. So it was really a very one-sided, solution to a very complicated problem. But that solution, it was too early in the game to go into all of that. And the legal attorneys that the NAACP had did not have the foresight to see these problems as they would unfold in America. The interpretation was left that every school district and every community would have to hash out this problem and find their own watermark, their own solution to the problem. And that's what Champaign did. And we're still in the process of trying to find that solution.
Okay. Some of the black leaders were calling for integration. The NAACP cited as one reason for this poor student grades, poor teaching staff, and disciplinary problems at the black schools. Did you agree with the NAACP's terms, or did you think that they should have had another basis?
Well, the NAACP did not describe the problems in that fashion here. The comparison wasn't kids in special education, disciplinary problems, and all of that. Prior to the desegregation of the Champaign schools, we got beat in school. We got our hands beat by paddles. We got beat by razor straps. There were no special rooms you went to. You got your butt whooped. You were carried in the cloakroom, and the whole classroom heard you. Your parents were called, and they came to the school, and then they beat you in front of the class. So it wasn't no timeout. You didn't get sent down to the library. No one sent you home. You act up in school, you dealt with the principal. And if you couldn't deal with the principal, you dealt with the janitor. Between the two of them, one of them was going to win. So we didn't have a disciplinary problem as we see in our schools today. So that kind of problem didn't exist then.
So there wasn't no special education rooms or none?
Well, there was special education, but it was not special education as we see it now. The issue that the NAACP argued about here was the overall benefit that black kids would obtain from the integration of the schools, and the fact that there was 3 learning year difference between blacks and whites. And they felt that by closing or integrating the schools or desegregating the schools, you would close that learning gap. I mean, to understand, the average black kid in the Champaign schools is almost at a 5-year learning difference from their white counterpart.
Now. Who say?
Who says is the school district's records. And how do you say that? By you look at the ISEP test, you look at other testing, and you look at the achievement rate. You look at the numbers of kids who are meeting state average. You look at the numbers of kids who are meeting national average. And you look at the numbers of kids who are meeting the district's average. I'm talking about achievement averages. The reason that the Bush administration enacted No Child Left Behind, because those differences, his wife being a school teacher, was aware of those growing enormous gaps in learning between children of color in our nation.
But doesn't the No Child Left Behind thing, I might not be right, but don't that make, like, if you're behind in school, like, they still pass you up to the next grade?
No, it makes that you cannot do that. Oh. It means that you cannot do it. It means that given a certain amount of time, school districts must bring up an equal learning, equal achievement level of all children. Now, if you go back and if you say, well, John, you're right, the real differences lies in preparation of children, then that means that more money should be put into kindergartens, programs, more money should be put into Head Start, more money should be put into preschools, more money should be put into elementary schools, and parents of colors should be given more resources. One of the reasons that there's only one neighborhood in Champaign County with a library, what neighborhood is that?
Douglas.
And why does Douglas Center, why is it the only neighborhood in Champaign County with a library? Do you know?
Well, I know that's the north end, but...
Because of the learning gap.
But it's still a gap.
No, because of the learning gap. And the idea was, if a library was placed closer to you, you would use it more. You would read more. And as a result of using the library more, when you got into school, you would be better prepared. And that gap would not be there.
But is that the case?
Well, no, it's not the case. Because many black families don't use the library, the main library or Douglas Center, as they should. Now, after saying all of that, see, this is why I'm saying this is tricky. Head Start children. And our country spends about $5 million a year in Champaign County on Head Start. Okay? And Head Start is just that. It's to give children a head start. But yet Head Start children who go into the Champaign schools after the third year, they drop off. And that's unexplainable. Despite everything that they've been given in Head Start, and they've been given all of this preschool preparation, all of this, because the national government mandates the curriculum to make sure that they're getting the same kinds of supports that they're getting in these middle-class homes. Yet when these black kids go through Head Start and get into Champaign schools, when they get to the third grade, that learning differences still exist between them and whites.
I know my mom is one of the directors at Head Start, and she sometimes she tells me, like, that there's low-income kids that come there, but there's not a motivation at home. And so when they get there, they're not motivated to learn, and then they send them home, and they send them back. And then she said most of their parents is prejudiced against some of the teachers, so they go home and they say, well, you don't need to listen to her, da-da-da-da-da-da, she's just being racist.
Parents have a tendency of doing that, but part of the role of Head Start, which is, we've changed Head Start nationally and we've changed it locally. Head Start used to be a breeding ground for low-income parents to become school teachers and to become administrators. It used to be that primarily the workforce of Head Start were parents who had children initially in Head Start. Now the rules are mandated by Congress that Head Start teachers must be certified and that they all must be working towards a 4-year certificate in education. That's a Congress rule in order for a Head Start program to maintain its funding. As a result of that, you bring in teachers who are not necessarily committed to the children, as the old Head Start teachers were committed to them. And there is this belief too often by low-income parents that their job is to defend their children against the teachers, as opposed to supporting the teachers to help the teachers help the child learn. And that goes back to the whole question about poor preparation at home. Poor preparation at home. Your child cannot learn when your child will not follow directions, when your child has not been taught to be attentive, when your child runs all around the room, plays, or when your child is disobedient, or when your child has been taught that he or she can do whatever they want to because their mom, whomever, is going to defend them against the teacher. Normally what happens when children do that is that teachers spend less time with them to the point where no time is being spent with them. But that's not only a problem in Head Start. That's a problem in Central High School. That's a problem at Centennial High School for African-American children. That's a problem at Franklin. It's a problem at Jefferson. It's a problem at Edison.
So,
next question.
What was the impact of Dr. King's and John F. Kennedy's assassination in Champaign, and how did it affect the desegregation process?
Well, I think everyone in Champaign was saddened. I was working with youth when the night that Dr. King was killed, and I was having a rally at Birch Village. And I had went in and told that rally that Dr. King had been assassinated and asked for a moment of silence and attempted to get them to pledge themselves, to improve themselves, to honor his life work. And I left there and went out to a rally that was at, I can't think of the church. there was a church on campus that there was a rally, and I went out to that rally. John F. Kennedy had the same kind of impact for different reasons on the black community. For the first time, black people saw, I think, a president who they thought was committed to social change that would improve their lives, where in fact, Harry Truman may have been a better socially minded president than John F. Kennedy. Clearly, John F. Kennedy was not Lyndon Johnson when it came to enacting legislation that integrated the races and gave civil rights to African-American people. But I think that John F. Kennedy's death, his brother's death, had a lot to do with the directions that President Johnson went. And it served as an impetus for Dr. King and others to go and to demand that Congress move forward on those rights. But now, see, I was working in Northeast Champaign dealing with other issues. I mean, I was dealing with youth. I was dealing with problems of the quality of our neighborhood, issues like this. And I was looking at Dr. King from afar. There were people, because Dr. King was a church person as well as a civil rights leader, there were church people who was committed to his issues because of that connection between church and civil rights. I was not in church in the sense that I was an elder in church. So I was trying to bring or help young people in our community, and I was trying to learn more about how to redevelop our neighborhoods and do things like that. But it clearly had an impact, but it didn't change my strategy. It didn't change my approach to my neighborhood and my approach to the community, because my approach wasn't created through my connection to them.
Okay, going back to the situation at the school where you did something, you got into trouble. Did you ever do anything to get
going
you
back
in
to
trouble?
The situation in school when I got into trouble?
When about the, like, if you got in trouble, you would get whooped on your hand or something.
Oh, okay.
Going back to that situation, did you ever do anything to get that while you were at school?
A couple of times I got my hands slapped by the teacher, and a couple of times I got my behind whooped by the teacher. It was things that you didn't normally do because you understood what was going to happen. So that served. But kids were kids. We didn't have television. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have movies as you guys have movies. There wasn't any MTD. We had different kinds of influences on us that you have on you today. We didn't have, cigarettes were there, but cigarettes was not a normal part of our lives. No one ever had marijuana. No one ever had hardcore drugs. There were kids who were in groups, but they were not gangs. Those kinds of problems. The school districts were in complete control of the schools when I went to school. You did everything that you were told to do by teachers and everything that you were told to do by administrators. You did not talk back to anyone, and you did what your parents told you to do. In a lot of kids' lives today, that's somewhat different. Kids go to school being their own parent, mm-hmm. and controlling their own destiny. And kids operate in different kinds of groups, and they have different kinds of pressures being brought on them today. But it's not new. It's not new. There were pressures in my lifetime that were new. They were new. So MTD is television, but there were different pressures that were brought on us. There were pressures that were not brought on our parents. And when kids think that they're dealing with something new, it's not new. It's just outside pressures that they have to deal with, and they have to come to understand how to put those things aside and to continue on with what their responsibilities are, which is to go to school to learn and to prepare themselves to go to the next stage of life.
Thank you.
Do you think now that there are as many black leaders as there were back when the desegregation process was going on?
No. There are more now than there were then. But the paradox could be, although there were fewer leaders then, that people listened to leaders more then than they do now. Because people have so much information coming at them now that they feel that they are as much of a leader themselves as men and women were back then. Because what made people leaders were that they had information, and they were using that information. A lot of people have information today, but they don't use it. They just store it. And when they don't store it, they just chunk it away. So although there are more people with information, they don't use it. I mean, we didn't have computers. We didn't have access to any computers. I mean, if you want to know about the Champaign schools, you can look it up on eBay. You know, you couldn't do that then. You know, you want to know about the University of Illinois, go to their website. There was no website then. You know, there could have been, but we didn't know anything about it. So there are great advantages today to help kids learn and to be better citizens than we had. In fact, it was harder for us to be citizens when I grew up, much harder then than it is for you. Even despite the fact that you got all these different things coming at you than we had. The question is how do you deal with them? Because we didn't have access to all the things that you have to help you. See? But a lot of kids don't recognize that these things are here to help them. So as a result of it, they don't use them. And kids who do use them don't necessarily share with other kids that they're usable, which is why when you go to a university, 90% of the way that you must communicate is through what? That's a question. Through computers.
Yeah, like email and stuff.
Yes, through computers. Everything now is told to you through computers. It's told to you through computers. Everything. And the reason, and even schools who are helping kids understand and use computers. And that's why there are now computers in public places. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, for you to understand that that's the tool of tomorrow. That is the tool of tomorrow. Well, there was not that tool. I mean, it has taken me 45 years to be John Lee Johnson. You can be John Lee Johnson in 3 years. And you're finding that how can you be John Lee Johnson in 3 years? Very simply. Everything that I've learned is right in there. It took me 45 years to learn it. You can learn it in less than 3 years just by accessing it. I spent my whole life trying to understand urban renewal and understand the politics of our national government related to the redevelopment of neighborhoods. It's right in that machine right there. You can find it.
Who says it's going to take me 3 years?
Well, I know a whole lot. That's only one aspect of what I know. But what I'm saying to you, you can learn what I know. It took me 45 years. You can learn it in 3 years.
Okay.
So that's a heck of a difference in span of time.
Do you think that people learn better back then when they didn't have computers or now when they do?
I think it has to do with the motivation. And it has to do with who you're with and who you're around. I really didn't start learning until I met a school teacher in Urbana, a retired white school teacher who had retired and came back to teach and who had graded one of my tests in contemporary history. And when the class let out, she said, John, can I talk to you? And she showed me my test with all these red marks on it. And she said, John, look at your test. And she said, this is not good, John. And she said, you only have a little time left in school, and you're going to have to work very hard to catch up because there was that gap between me and the other kids. And I never forgot that. And that became, it served as an engine that drove me from the day I left Mrs. Lawson's class and even till the day. So you really never know what's going to stimulate a kid. You know, it could be stimulated by computers. It could be stimulated by television. It could be stimulated by books. It could be stimulated just by the friends that they know. It can be stimulated by a movie. It could be stimulated by anything that could serve to wake you up and knock you on your hard head that, hey, I've wasted a lot of time in school, and I don't have but a little time left, and I better get busy because everybody's going to leave me behind. But we talked about that kind of stuff as kids. A lot of kids today don't talk about that. They don't get on each other about the books that they're carrying up and down the hallways. We used to always look at each other's books because the books told you what they were doing. I mean, you know, if you don't see trigonometry, you don't see chemistry, that tells you that, you know, these kids are going out the door backwards. You know, that how in the world are they going to a four-year institution? There's no foreign language. How are you going to go into an institution? You only have practical math. You know, who's going to hire you? Where are these jobs at? You know, the jobs are not out there. And then you go out and you have a baby. Who's going to help you take care of the baby? You go out there, man or boy or girl, who's going to help you pay for the baby? Who's going to help you raise the baby? So no one is talking about this kind of stuff. What kids are talking about too much of is being cool. Kids are talking about how not to assume a responsibility. And too many kids that are good kids are being shocked out of being good by their peers who are telling them, girl, you just think you're so smart because you got them books. You think you're trying to be somebody. And they don't want to be outside of their peers. And they want to be well-liked. You know? What does well-liked have to do with who's going to buy your home? You know, who's going to send your children to college? Nobody. Nobody. You all going to live in public housing together because you all liked each other? The answer to that is no. That's not the solution. So the place that you get that foundation is in school. And if, in fact, you're 5 years behind, how do you catch up? How do you catch up? It's not rocket science. It's not rocket science. I tell you what you and your friend do. One day, one Saturday, go out to the university and go to the Union Building. You know what the Union Building is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And go downstairs or go out on the quad on a nice summer day. And what you will find are groups of kids in groups studying together. And what they're doing is helping each other learn. I mean, and so you find kids who are strong in something and weak in something else. And you bring the strengths and the weaknesses together. You know, like you may be able to sew well, but I can cook. So if you sew this button on for me, I'll make you a pie. If you can do algebra better than I can, I'll come over and you'll help me figure out the algebra problems and I'll help you write your paper. That kind of thing. Well, that kind of partnershiping is not going on. And the reason that everybody else is accelerating quicker in their learning process than African-American children is because we don't bridge one another.
Some African-American
children. Well, some African-American children. Well, you know, I mean, I tell you, if there's 100 kids mm-hmm. and only 10 of those kids are succeeding and 90 of them are not, that is a number that ought to scare the heck out of you. That for every 100 kids at your middle school, only 10 are meeting district's average. That tells you that when you become my age, there won't be anybody looking like you and me in leadership positions. There will not be. And either you're going to sit back and allow those kids to destroy themselves because they're taking other avenues because, you know, they can't do it. So they might as well make fun, have a good time, do things that really don't make any sense. You know, you bring attention to themselves because they can't stand up and raise their hand and answer the question. They can't go to the blackboard and solve the problem. They can't go and do the research on the paper. So, you know, they'll do the booty call. They'll do something that's cute. Instead of we serving as a family trying to say that ain't going to get it. I mean, these are things that fundamentally we have to do to achieve, because achieving is not easy. If it was easy, we would all be Einsteins. You know, if God would have wanted you and me to come here as geniuses, we'd have come out of our mother's wombs as such. It's an evolutionary process that we have to learn, and it's not easy. But one of the things that we know, that the brain is almost as wide and as deep as the universe. It is an unbelievable computer storing information and figuring out problems, and that there is no problem that the human brain cannot master. So the trigonometry book, the chemistry book, the brain can master it because it took a brain to develop it. We just have to convince ourselves of that. And we just have to convince each other of that. So when you go down your halls, always tomorrow, just look at what the kids are carrying in their hands. It tells you. Look at how the boys are dressed. And it tells you where their minds are. You know. And go over to the Family Information Center one day with your mom and ask for a report card on your building. Ask for an achievement card. And look at that achievement card by race. And go and ask for it about the district. I think the district could be online. Look it up. I mean, that's what this is for. I mean, if I gave you a problem and you're not sure of that problem or my answer, go look it up. And then call me back and say, aha, Mr. Johnson, that was not right. Or if I'm right, you need to stand up in front of your mom and say, let's go to church. Because I want to stand up after the sermon and say to the pastor, do you know that 80% of the kids at Jefferson School who are black cannot read at the district's level, cannot meet the state level, cannot meet the national level? And do you know what the implications of that is to our race of people? Do you understand that? And if the issue is that we're not preparing our kids, what can we do about that? What strategies should we have at home? What should we be doing in our churches? What should we be doing in our community? Where should our emphasis be? Or if not, this gap is going to grow so far that we are virtually going to become an illiterate race of people in the most industrialized nation in the world. We won't be able to use technology. We won't be able to communicate. We won't be able to find employment because we would not have the basic skills that are necessary to survive. That's what this is about. This isn't just about you doing a school project. This is about training you to survive and training you to be a better American. Because somewhere over in Korea, South and North, somewhere in China, somewhere in India, somewhere in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, there are little girls like the two of you who are busting their behinds to try to learn everything that they possibly can. So when those few jobs are available on the world's market, they got them. You don't. When that great company is asking for that new engineer to figure out that new project, they can figure it out. You can't. And when they're deciding where to put that factory because they need the highest intelligence and the skilled level people to do that job, they'll build it in their city and not yours. And you'll be sitting here wondering, why don't we have a job? I mean, why can't we buy a new car? Why can't we do all of that? And if you stand back and trace all of that problem, it's with our education. It's with all of that. Now, the good thing about what I'm saying is that this is all factual evidence. I mean, you go back 30 years or 40 years ago when we were arguing DSEG issues, this was just from the gut. We now have facts that this is indeed the case. Look at the Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois, where Mitsubishi selected certain employees to work for them. And if you didn't have certain IQs, certain curriculums in high school, you did not go to work for them. And that's applying today. So kids who are walking away from their math, walking away from their science, walking away from their literature courses, walking away from technology courses, who will employ them? They won't even be able to work at McDonald's because everything there is becoming computerized. So how are you going to work? You can't. And this message is not being brought home. Hopefully, they hear this tape.
Yeah.
What's the next question?
Okay. After you sued the Unifor School District, what kind of changes occurred?
Very little. There were changes that occurred. We got the court to overlook the school district, which it is now. We have a monitor who serves the court in auditing what the schools are doing or not doing and reporting that to the court. We have a policy implementation committee that's made up of citizens, school officials, and a university professor of education who helps in interpreting and setting policies and guidelines for the schools towards the consent decree. But I'm looking at it as how many kids are actually improving in their learning? How many kids are not being dumped into special education? How many kids are not being put in alternative education? How many kids are being sent to upper level courses? Those numbers are not changing. We're into 2.5 years, and those numbers have not changed. In fact, the numbers can be even a little worse than they were before 1997. And that's because you asked a question earlier, did anybody ask the white community if they really wanted to desegregate their schools? Because maybe they didn't. Well, it's like asking, did anyone ever ask the teachers, did they really want to assure equity for black kids in the Champaign schools? Because they didn't want the courts to mandate this on them. Clearly, they did not. And they're taking the attitude that despite the fact that we may have went to court and that we may have gotten a no contest position by them, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. We're not going to move your kids to upper level classes. We're not going to stop dumping them into special education. We're going to keep on doing business as we were doing it. And there ain't nothing you can do about it, John Lee. Why do you smile? I take that to be their attitude. Now, why would I say that? If you would look at the racial climate study that was done by Professor Hebert here at the University of Illinois, at the bequest of the federal government, their attitudes are as I just described them. You're not going to make us do anything.
I have to get you to Savoy by 6. We have one more question.
Dang. Oh, okay.
Pick your best last question.
Oh, is it the questions that are long or my answers?
I think it's your answer.
Okay. Why do you think that the percentage of black kids in honors class is very low?
I think for all the reasons that I gave, poor preparation, and in fact, that there's a gate kept at the door of the honor classes by teachers, philosophies of school administrators, and the positions of the schools themselves. It's like saying that despite all the things that have been done to black kids by us, that they are still achieving at a level that they're equal to our honor students. And by saying that they're not honor caliber students, we're saying that we were right, that inherently these kids are less achievers than our kids. Now, that's the evilness that can be embedded in race. And the learning philosophy of a community that all children must learn because the survival of a nation depends upon their learning has not risen to the top. There is a fundamental attitude by too many people who teach in the Champaign schools that race has all to do with who's going to be successful. And if you're not of the right race, then you're not going to be successful in the Champaign schools. And all these other issues, let other people figure that out. You know what I mean? Let other people figure out what's going to be the next generation of atomic bombs, the next generation of nuclear missiles and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? I ain't dealing with that. I'm only dealing with the children who are in front of me. And you better believe the children who come from Southwest Champaign are going to get the kids who are going to go to Harvard. And the kids who are black are not going to go to Harvard, not out of my school. Now, that sounds a little cruel. But when you go back and you look at all these numbers and you try to figure out an explanation for these numbers, there is no explanation. Because if you go back and compare the numbers to the school's budget, the school is not putting money into what other explanations could be in the budget. And if I'm right, that is preparation. Then why are we not spending more money to help these kids' families prepare them for schools? We're not spending money doing that. We're not spending money. Why is it that you don't find, or there are very few black kids that are in jazz bands? And jazz was a music created by black people. Why is that? because they require you to buy instruments. And most black families cannot afford the instruments, so hence their children don't play those instruments. And the illusion is that jazz is a music that was created by somebody other than children of color. Why is it that you don't find black kids in the band, but they're out there on the football field? Because you got to have an instrument. So this is a public education system. Why aren't those instruments not given to them to use for the time that they're using them? Because they know that you can segregate with money. If you want to have a housing policy that anybody can live in it, if you build houses that are so expensive, you exclude people. If you want to have a program that costs money, the people who cannot afford it are immediately excluded from it. So when you got open programs and you don't have to pay, then anybody can come. The way you exclude people is that you charge fees. You charge them fees. And that's what we see in our own schools. That's what's going on right here today. That's what goes on across our nation.
I'm going to ask a question that Tiara had. She was listening on the headphones. She wanted to ask you to tell them what the People's Poverty Board was.
The People's Poverty Board was a reaction to issues of poverty here in Champaign, Urbana, Champaign County. It consisted of Roy Williams, John Lee Johnson, and Peter Rasmussen. We worked to create the Black Student Association at the University of Illinois. We wrote the first black newspaper, maybe not the first black newspaper, but we wrote a newspaper called Spectrum. Wrote a poem to excite black kids called The Fighting Black Illini. We dealt with school desegregation, the urban renewal programs, other issues, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana Schools. We ran candidates for the Urbana School Board, the Champaign School Board, Champaign City Council, things like that. I think we operated it for, what, maybe 10 years.
Okay.